Copyright Stanford University, all rights reserved.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. My name is Paul Yonk. I'd like to say hello on behalf of the BioDesign program. I have just one important announcement to make, which is obviously we're recording this presentation, so if you could please turn your cell phones to a silent mode, that would be great. David is going to introduce our honored guest in just a minute, but I want to say thank you to the sponsors for this evening, Wilson Sonsini and PricewaterhouseCoopers, and also mention that at the end of the session we'll have a reception just out back here, so please hang around. Also, we'll have the opportunity for questions at the end, and there is, I guess, one central microphone here. So David will call for questions at that time. Please feel free to come up. So with no further ado, let's get going.
Thank you, Paul. Thanks very much. Well, I think I speak on behalf of the entire community to say that how grateful we are, Alex, to have you here. And just in case anybody wondered, no, you don't call up the newly appointed CEO of Johnson & Johnson just after the announcement and ask if you'd like to come out. We've had Alex on the agenda for a while here. So. I'm going to ask a couple of questions about the pharma world, but this is really going to focus a lot on the medical devices because, frankly, that's what I know, and I don't know the pharma world at all. So let me just begin with your background. I think most people who know that you graduated from West Point and served in the Army for 6 years after that. What made you decide that there was that was not going to be your career, that you wanted a career in industry? Was there an epiphany? Was there a moment of realization when you said, this is not for me, I want to go into industry?
Sure, David. But hey, before I answer that, first of all, I just want to thank Paul again for a great afternoon. I got a chance to spend most of the afternoon with the BioDesign team, seeing a number of other ventures, and what a great program, very inspiring, certainly made me rethink a lot of the things about we do already. So I'm sure that some of my J&J colleagues that were here with are gonna have a lot of follow-ups coming out of it, but you know, I really appreciate it. And second of all, I would just wanna thank all of the J&J colleagues that are here because were it not for them, there's no way we'd be doing what we're doing. So thanks to all of you. And like you said, I started in the industry actually right out of West Point, and the first place where I was stationed is I came out to the Defense Language Institute down in Monterey.
Okay.
And then went over to Europe for a year, and then came back and was stationed at Fort Ord, California, and got out of the Army there. And I wish I could say that I had this grand plan that I knew all along I was going to go into healthcare. And for those of you who had that kind of vision very early on, God bless you. For me, I wasn't sure what I wanted to do.
Did you consider a number of different industries?
I did. I'm an engineer by training. And so I looked a lot at the tech industry in the Bay Area. I actually applied to Stanford University's MBA program and was rejected.
we'll get you an honorary degree at
some point. Throughout my life, I toyed with the idea of going to med school. I met my wife out here, who's actually in the audience, who is a nurse. A number of people in my family were involved in medicine, and I'd always had a real interest in health. And so as I thought about it in I guess the old-fashioned way, through a family relative who happened to be affiliated with Johnson & Johnson, working with them at the time, said, you should give this company a try. And the more research I did, the more looking I did, I said, this is not only a great industry, but it's a great company. And so that's where I started.
So you started as a rep on the pharma side, and I understand this was your territory.
This is my territory. So
you must have done a great job.
When I tell people I started as a pharmaceutical representative in Monterey, California, is that a great job or what? And I only had to close trunks about 5 days in the rain. But it's eerie, even when Paul picked me up today and we were driving over here, it's always a unique experience for me because in my mind that was like yesterday. And in 1988, I remember driving around the Stanford Shopping Center after not being able to see a physician or having a bad day and stopping to get a cappuccino thinking, what am I ever gonna do with my career? And to think that I'm back here now with this kind of an opportunity, it's a dream come true.
Yeah, your career's kind of done pretty well for itself.
Oh.
So you spent the first 15 years at Johnson & Johnson. And before moving to Novartis, before I talk about the leap to Novartis, give us a little sense of how your career trajectory at Johnson & Johnson went. How long did you spend as a rep, and did you just move up through the sales management cycle system?
What happened is I started with Janssen, and Janssen at that time was really a startup company within Johnson & Johnson. In fact, the year that I started, we hit $100 million in sales. Mm-hmm. And it was a jewel of an R&D organization. Dr. Paul Janssen, for those that you don't know, is really one of the most prolific discoverers of drugs. I think at one time he had more products on the World Health Organization list of essential drugs than anybody else. Just a brilliant guy. I was fortunate to get to spend quite a bit of time with him. But we started, and then we had a series of compounds that were introduced in the 90s. And so over a period of about literally 12 years, we went from 100 million to almost 3 billion wow. in sales. And it was on the back of some really life-changing, life-saving compounds. Risperdal, was probably the, but fentanyl, Alfenta, Sufenta, Propulsid, unfortunately, we later pulled from the market. It was an incredible run during that period. And to watch the organization grow, I think when I joined, I was close to maybe the 300th employee. So it was in the pharma world, as all of you know, that's almost a startup mentality. Yeah. And when you launch your product, everybody would be in the cafeteria on Saturday with the, loading boxes to get things sent out. And to be part of that and watch it grow. And I spent really only about 18 months as a sales representative. I was then a sales manager, one of the toughest jobs ever. I was actually in Pittsburgh.
Okay.
And then I transitioned into marketing, where I ended up taking various responsibilities for different parts of the organization, and ultimately got to be president of Janssen in about 2001, I believe.
So at that point, you moved to Novartis. Why? I mean, did you feel your career at Johnson & Johnson had stalled at all?
Before that, I J&J came to me, and I'll never forget, I'd only been president of Janssen for a couple years, and they said, the good news is you're doing okay. The challenge is we want to stretch you a little bit more. So they asked me to go over and take responsibility for J&J's pharmaceutical business in Europe, the Middle East, and Africa, mm-hmm. and Russia. And, my wife and I were very excited about it, but we had a son who's about in eighth grade at the time. That's a big move. He was excited about it. We moved over to London, and tremendous experience. I'd highly recommend that for anybody. Mm-hmm. If you get a chance to go global, go as soon as you can to learn the different markets, the different healthcare systems. And what they tell you is, when I first got there, they said that, when you go to the UK, the plans are going to be very good, and everything will be very, very well articulated. When you go to Germany, it's going to be a lot of precision with the plans. When you go to Italy, everything's going to be about innovation. And I went over there and I worked with them, and I found all of that to be absolutely true. But learning that, especially for somebody who'd only worked in the United States before, I'd lived abroad a little bit when I was in the military, it was a great experience. But what happened? I'd been with Johnson & Johnson my entire career. And you always think, well, what's that grass like on the other
right.
side? And it just so happened that somebody who was a mentor of mine, and I had actually been about a 30-year leader at Johnson & Johnson, Paulo Costa, who was president of Janssen when I was younger, had been at Novartis. We happened to bump into each other, had a conversation. One thing led to another. And I decided to take a leap, and I joined Novartis.
And what did you do at Novartis, and how long were you there?
I went to Novartis as the chief operating officer for North America.
Okay.
And then about 18 months after that, I became CEO or head of the Americas for them. And it was a great experience. I couldn't have picked a more diametrically opposed company to Johnson & Johnson than Novartis. One is very decentralized, one is very centralized. One was very U.S., based in the U.S., other, quite Swiss. One in, consumers, pharma, and medical devices. The other, more in generic businesses, oncology, as well as pharma and some consumer business. But out of that, I think whenever you stretch yourself as a leader and have to learn new therapeutic areas, new processes, new ways of thinking, it definitely made me a better leader.
Mm-hmm. So then you came back to Johnson & Johnson, and you came back on the device side. Was that part of a kind of calculated career path? What made you come back to Johnson & Johnson? And when the offer to come back and to work on the device side, was that attractive to you, or was it kind of like, okay, let me let me come back in devices, but I'd still like to get back to the pharma side.
You know, it always amazes me now in my job, David, that when people will come into me sometimes asking for mentoring, they'll bring in these thick packets and this, you know, PERT diagram that, you know, basically wants to show their career progression, what they're going through. And sometimes I scratch my head after that and go, how the hell did I ever get where I am? Because I never had put things like that together through my career. And I mentioned earlier that was there a grand design about coming into healthcare. But even in this case, you know, when I came back, I had some initial conversations with Johnson & Johnson, with Bill, with Sherry, and, you know, our head of HR at the time. And I knew in my heart of hearts that I was a Johnson & Johnson person. In fact, I can remember being at Novartis, and one time when it really struck me, somebody came in and said, you know, you're Alex Gorsky, you're really kind of a J&J guy. I said, well, what does that mean?
Was that
a compliment?
Well,
yeah, I said, is that a compliment or is that not? But it was one of those things where I think I knew in my heart that was the right place for me. And fortunately, and again, somewhat through accident, I happened to bump into some people and got back in. When we were talking about it, you know, the chance to cross sector, and frequently in J&J, we sell the corporation as an opportunity to say we're the most diversified healthcare company out there. You know, not only from a technology and platform point of view, but from a career point of view, you can, you know, spend time in devices, you can be in pharma and consumer. We talk about it probably better than we do it a lot of the time. And so when I was coming back, getting a chance to go into a different sector, and again, and having made that one transition from J&J to Novartis, I thought, what a great way to come back and learn a different business. And when you think about it, you know, Bill started his career in pharma. My boss, the current chairman and CEO. He then went from pharma to Ethicon Endosurgery and really created that organization when they were first going against U.S. Surgical, and then went back to pharma, of course, before he became CEO. If you look at Sherry McCoy, you know, the vice chair, Sherry started in consumer on the R&D side, went to MD&D, then had pharma. So, you know, I think what we found is that, you know, moving some of our executives around, it does open up your way of thinking, gives you a different perspective. And you know, I'm sure we'll talk about this more later. I think convergence is a big opportunity going forward.
Yeah, we will talk about that, and also about Ethicon, because you came back as group chairman, and Ethicon's always had a kind of special place, it seems to me, within Johnson & Johnson. But if you think about it, I mean, some people think about Johnson & Johnson as a pharma company. Some people think of it as a consumer products, Band-Aids, and shampoo and that kind of stuff. But right now, and I think under your leadership, medical devices is now the biggest part of Johnson & Johnson, and Johnson & Johnson is the largest medical device company in the world. When you got there, I wonder, were you more struck by the similarities between pharma and devices or the differences, and were you struck, as sometimes I am, at the kind of breadth and depth of the device business here? I mean, I think we still tend to think about the device business as not so much an also-ran, but it's really Johnson & Johnson's, you know, not by a huge margin, but it's Johnson & Johnson's largest business.
Yeah, it was a great experience, and I was struck by a lot of things when I went into it. And first of all, having been in the pharma business through the 90s, when pharma, you know, was growing at a double-digit rate, and you were thinking about, you know, Ethicon that time was considered pretty much a suture company. And I remember when I came back, I said, okay, how difficult can this be? It's a suture. It's needle and thread. And quickly, our scientist said, no, you don't understand. And you go in and you talk to the person that 35 years ago actually developed the very first absorbable suture. And you realize that we've got, you know, thousands of SKUs on sutures, some done specifically for particular surgeons that have, you know, reabsorption rates at a particular time frame where the, you know, needle has a certain, you know, curvature to it, a certain strength and durability. And so really getting in, understanding that technology, it certainly appealed to me as an engineer. But it opened up an entirely another door. Then you thought, okay, we took that suture technology, you weave that together to form mesh. And you think about all the different applications that we had for mesh women's healthcare products. And so it was a great transition, but you could immediately see the differences. I mean, one of the greatest differences right away were the innovation cycles.
Right.
You know, in pharmaceuticals, it's well known, depending on which database you're going to look at, it's going to be about $1.5 billion to $2 billion to bring a product to market. It's probably going to take you about 13 to 14, 15 years. And so the decisions you make early on, phase one, phase two, have, you know, multi-billion dollar implications downstream, and that's the nature of it. You come to MD&D, and right away you find out, gosh, for anywhere from $5 to $50 million, and usually in 18, sometimes to 36 months, I can bring out, you know, rapid innovation. So the whole life cycle is much more consumer-like than it was on the pharma side. The other thing that I found very, very different, it's one thing if you're talking to a physician about using this pill or that pill, because then he or she simply gives an instruction to the patient about when to take it. But when you're talking about a medical device, what I really found at Ethicon was it comes alive, and Tom, you'll probably support me in this, it comes alive in the physician's hands. You know, a suture is a suture, but it has a different feel. You don't see the benefit of that product till it's put in a physician's hand. So the relationship with the physician and the surgeon and the company and developing, it's a very different paradigm than what you find on the pharma side.
It always occurred to me that one other major difference is the pharma industry brands itself through its products, but the device industry brands itself through corporate identity. You walk around the AOS meeting, orthopedic surgeons, or ACC or American Heart, and you immediately know the difference between the pharma companies and the device companies, because the device companies are all about Johnson & Johnson, Ethicon and Medtronic and Cordis and DePuy, and the pharma companies are all about the individual drug brands. Yeah. And that always struck me as that there wasn't that same kind of corporate identity on the part of the pharma. It's really about the compound and the physician relationship.
It's definitely more compound focused. Again, I see this with Ethicon all the time. When you talk to surgeons about Ethicon suture, their hands almost come up like this.
Yeah.
Because it's such a reflexive action. And so, getting a chance to work in that environment, we really tried to diversify the portfolio, working closely with Susan Morano at the time in BD and Bridget Ross, who actually now, we diversified into the ENT space with Acclarent, diversified into more the aesthetic space with Mentor, mm-hmm. the more the biologic space with Omrix. Ethicon today is a very different company than it was 10 years ago. But what's great about it is you've got this core platform in sutures and mesh, and what we try to do is surround that with a lot of opportunities for growth, and it's really one of the true jewels within Johnson & Johnson.
So, as you say, the business has evolved over the course of the last couple of years. 2011 seemed to me to be a particularly significant year for the medical device businesses. Let's talk about some of the things that happened. You had three important moves, and that led to a reorganization. The first, the kind of highest profile, most surprising, was the departure from coronary stents. Given that Johnson & Johnson Cordis had been a pioneer of both bare metal and drug-eluting stents, how difficult a decision was that for you guys to make? And what are the implications for Johnson & Johnson's cardiovascular business going forward?
Well, it's a great question. And it's certainly one that, as you can imagine, took a lot of debate, of rigorous thinking, and challenge as we went through it. At the end, though, I feel it was, and we feel, it was absolutely the right decision. Let me give you some of our thinking.
Sure.
I think one of the biggest challenges you face in a company like J&J, where we're $65 billion in sales, we'll invest over $7 billion in research. And the challenge is, where do you say no?
Yeah.
Because if you're not really rigorous and disciplined in, where you're going to go, where you're not going to go, you'll just, every opportunity is a great opportunity. And so as we looked at it, we always really try to start with, where's the unmet medical need? And ultimately, where can you most help patients? And we're very proud of the fact that in the stent category, we were there with the first bare metal stent. We came out later with the first drug-eluting stent. We believe we played a critical role in advancing that field and saving a lot of lives and really making a difference. But then once you had four or five stents out there, and you started looking at, what was the true differentiation that you were going to be able to provide patients? Were you going to go from late stent thrombosis, rates of, 93 point, and these aren't the right numbers, 93.4 to 94.2, but you were going to have to invest $200 million to do the clinical trials to be able to get that claim, and we started weighing that out. And by the way, this was during a period when the stent market for many years had grown at a double-digit rate in the high single or low double digits, and suddenly that was flat. When you saw pricing going down as much as 8 or 10% a year, we finally had to ask ourselves, what's better for patients and what's better for our organization for our next dollar of investment, putting it in the next stent or putting it in the next generation lens, the next generation endovascular procedure or other areas? We felt there were other opportunities that were better. But you gotta believe, given
it must have been difficult.
Everything that we had into it. But I think that's, it's also reflective of an organization that we know trying to renew itself. And particularly a large organization where you have a lot of momentum in place. You've built infrastructure, people have built careers around that. To make those calls is a challenge, but I think it's absolutely essential.
I was talking to somebody about it, and this person said to me, this may not be the end, that if Johnson & Johnson saw a great opportunity to acquire its way back into the stent business, they'll do that. Is that wishful thinking? Is that your view that ship has sailed, or do you hold open the possibility? Again, what did it say about the cardiovascular business? Now, coronary stents are a huge part of the armamentarium that you provide to interventionalists. As you said, the relationship with customers is so intimate because it is an instrument in their hands. Does it diminish Johnson & Johnson as an interventional cardiology company not to have that? And could you see yourself getting back into this business?
We think, look, as the world's largest healthcare company and the most diverse, cardiovascular area is very important. I mean, it's very important for patients, and I think ultimately it's going to be very important for our business. And what I would say is that when we see technology, and again, that could be pharmaceutical, that can be medical devices, where we think it can really make a difference, and we think we can build the right capabilities around that, absolutely we're going to be interested.
So I don't mean to put you on the spot, but I mean, was Conner Med Systems, was that kind of the deal that where you said, okay, the future investments really make this, was that a kind of watershed thinking for Johnson & Johnson? Even after Conner had difficulty in his first clinical trials, a lot of people said, don't worry, this is going to be the platform. Was Conner Med Systems central to that thinking?
Well, it's always difficult because, look, we're constantly looking at technologies, and in hindsight, it's always 2020,
look
back at that and say, we could have done this or we would have done that differently. I think ultimately, just when we saw the way that market was evolving, we saw the way the technology was developing, and then we looked at, again, the relative impact we could have with patients versus the investments it was going to take. We netted all that out. We felt it was best to go in other places.
So the other major move that you made in 2011 was the acquisition of Synthes. Talk about what Synthes does for the orthopedics line. And I want to talk to you about the reorganization in a second, but obviously
sure. It
feels to someone from the outside as if orthopedics has now taken a huge step forward in terms of being a kind of core device business for Johnson & Johnson.
We're still not done yet. We're still on target, we believe, to close in the first half of this year. But we look at a lot of different things, as I was talking about earlier, when we're looking at acquisition targets. And it starts with unmet need. And it starts with, what does that market look like? What's your competition look like? What's the future going to be? And when we looked at that point in time, prior to Synthes, the largest company that we had within our medical device area was DePuy. But if you looked at orthopedics, DePuy had a very strong position in hips and knees. We had a rapidly growing sports medicine business, a good neurovascular business, and we had a very small trauma business at that time. And if you look in that market, you had, again, about five companies, all pretty evenly split among share. And for those of you that have really looked at any business cases, how often does a market exist where you've got about five or six players with equal share, over a longer period, protracted period of time? And so when we looked at that area, we started saying, okay, what are the areas that's growing the fastest? Well, if you broke it down even further and looked at all those different markets that I just mentioned, by far the fastest growing was trauma. And what that meant is that that trauma space was growing in the high single digits. The other markets were growing in the mid single digits. But if you peeled the skin of the onion back one more time, what you found was that particularly in emerging markets, surgery by definition is really trauma, because in places like China and India, you're not seeing as many hip and knee, yet you're seeing a lot of trauma cases. So when we thought about our strategy is, where's a fast-growing market? Where's a market where we have a relatively low share compared to the others? And where do we see an opportunity to accelerate our growth even more in emerging markets? And we add that together, and it was clearly trauma, and it was Synthes. And then in the course of all that, Synthes, of course, decided that it would be a good strategic move for them to think about other strategic options. And that came together. And again, we feel that it really provides us a world-class position in orthopedics. And there, too, you know, those markets, as all med tech markets have softened, longer term, I don't think the number of, or the in terms of the need for hips, knees, sports medicine, trauma, is going to, you know, you won't be able to delay that forever. And so we're very excited about the opportunity. And the other portion of that, it will accelerate our growth in the emerging markets, let alone the developed right. markets. And I also think it'll give us a very comprehensive platform, not only when we can go in and talk to hospitals, but when we can go in, when you look at the capabilities that we can build around those various approaches.
So you say it hasn't closed yet. Forgive me if this is an inappropriate question then, but we'll again, talking about the brands, will Synthes operate independently? Will it be folded into DePuy? In a space like orthopedics where again, customers know brands, how will you put, because integration has always been a big issue in orthopedics, particularly around the sales force, how will you put, how will you manage Synthes?
I can't give you the exact answer because otherwise the DePuy Synthes team would kill me. But you know, needless to say, we think those are both great brands out there right now. DePuy is a very strong branding image, particularly over in Europe, but also in the U.S. Synthes, they've done a tremendous job, and in all of the research that we did, you know, in terms of quality, training, education, innovation, they came up very high. So we think that's it's really 1 + 1 = 4 pulling those two together.
So in talking about the orthopedic space, the one area you didn't mention was spine. A couple of years ago, everything you said about trauma, people would have said about spine. You're a strong number two in a market that has really seen us go from dramatic growth, double-digit growth, to negative growth. What do you think the future holds for spine? A couple of years ago, people were talking about artificial discs as the next drug-eluting stents, and that's a space which has struggled in the last couple of years.
Well, I think there are some differences. I think, you know, one, and you know, my failure to mention spine was just an oversight on my
part.
It's a very important business for us. And again, there too, you know, if I ask for people to raise their hands in here, who's got a bad back, right. I would imagine I'd see a number of hands go back or up. And so, you know, when you look at obesity, when you look at a lot of other things, I think the spine market long term is still a very good place to be. But when you look at some of the data that we've been able to produce in those spaces in trauma versus spine, for example, now, I'm quite confident that, you know, while there may be some fluctuations in relative growth rates, the trauma remains a very attractive space, and I think spine will be in the long run as well.
So it may just be that I'm a fossil or a dinosaur, but when I looked at all the things Johnson & Johnson did this year, the sale of Codman Shirtlift stood out for me, because when I first got into the new Codman Shirtlift was one of the top brands at Johnson & Johnson. Any comments about the divestiture of Codman Shirtlift and what it means? Because I want to talk to you in a second about the reorganization and how
sure.
it positions Johnson & Johnson going forward. But Johnson & Johnson is going to be a surgical, is putting a very heavy emphasis on surgery. I said trauma is a kind of surgery.
Right.
Why divest Codman Shirtlift then?
Well, you know, as I said earlier, I think one of the things that we've really tried to change in all of our businesses over the last few years is just being brutally disciplined about the choices we're making in our portfolio. And we spend a lot of time on that to make sure that, you know, where's that need, where can we invest the dollars to make the biggest difference, you know, versus those where we don't necessarily see that opportunity. And it's not only in terms of the return on the market, but it goes, where's the synergy in terms of capabilities, of technologies? What about capabilities with the, you know, people? So it's all those things put together. But, you know, we're trying to be, again, very aggressive in the way that we look at our entire portfolio to make those kind of decisions, ultimately to free up resources so that we can invest in the next Acclarent, the other next technology that we think can really make a difference.
So let's talk about the reorganization. You're now organized, or you will be going organized into three groups, orthopedic, surgical, and what's the third one?
Let me see, we've got Global Surgery, Orthopedics, and Global Solutions, Medical Solutions.
And what's involved in the last one?
Okay, we got Orthopedics all together.
Which we know about that.
Right, and that's, just to give you, put that in context a little bit, you know, we're going to have about a $10 billion orthopedics business. When Ralph Larson, the previous CEO, took over as CEO, that's about what the size of Johnson & Johnson was.
Wow.
And so with a medical device division of almost $30 billion, you start asking yourself a question, when does scale and size and bureaucracy start to work against you? And one of the things that we really love about trying to retain at Johnson & Johnson is how do you build that accountability, that ownership, that closeness to the customer? And so as I looked at how do you best organize, clearly orthopedics made sense because you're gonna have the world's leading orthopedics company. And when you looked at our surgery, I think it made eminent sense about 20 years ago when we had Ethicon that was predominantly a suture company. You're trying to build a minimally invasive surgery company. That company was always going to be subjugated to the demand of sutures if you didn't peel it out and really give it a chance to take off, fertilize it, nurture it the way that you need to get it to grow. But now when you think about it, if a surgeon's in doing a procedure, they don't see us as Ethicon Endosurgery and Ethicon. You know, they're gonna use an energy instrument, they're gonna use suture, they might use mesh, they might use another, you know, Evisil, one of our biologics. So we try to look at the customer call point. When that surgeon's in there, they wanna have basically one-stop shopping. Somebody's gonna service them and help them through that procedure. So bringing those businesses together, we thought made a lot of sense. And then the third area, Global Medical Solutions, was frankly more pragmatic than strategic.
Everything else.
But when you look at, there's some consumer tie over. If you look at our diabetes care business and our vision care business, you could argue that our diagnostics business might share some compatibilities with our diagnostics business. You could say the same thing about diagnostics has a capital sell, as well as our advanced sterilization products have a capital sell. But one thing that Carolyn Citra, who runs the third group, we really challenged her to say, look, what are also the next generation solutions outside of just products that we need to think about as Johnson & Johnson to help customers? And that's a space that we find intriguing, and we think more as not only surgeons but economic buyers within hospital systems start making more and more of the decisions, we've got to think about how do we present ourselves in a different way than just relying on the representative surgeon relationship that's been the business model for the medical technology area for so long. And so we think we have a great opportunity to do that.
And Cordis fits under the surgical products.
Cordis is in that section.
For years, it's been rumored that Cordis's next big move was going to be into CRM. Does that suggest now that it's in the surgical products group? Obviously, pacemakers and ICDs are implanted in a surgical procedure, but does that suggest that your passion or appetite for CRM is diminished at all?
No, as I said, we're always going to be on the lookout for categories and opportunities that we find attractive and that, you know, we think, you know, we'll better position the company that ultimately are going to help patients. There too, we felt that it was the best fold in the general surgery group for at this time.
So I want to talk a little bit about the whole notion of innovation. When I first got into this industry, Johnson & Johnson was a wound care and a wound closure company. It was Ethicon in patient care. Someone got hurt, you know, you closed it up and you healed it. Johnson & Johnson wasn't even in interventional cardiology, as you say, very small orthopedics business, J&J Professional. In the late 90s, mid to late 90s and early 2000s, it seemed Johnson & Johnson made a dramatic move into what I would call high-tech, strongly physician-preferred spaces, interventional cardiology, orthopedics, where technology turned over fairly rapidly. You know, we can talk about orthopedics, but that's, leave that as a thing. Does this reorganization, there's a lot of emphasis on the surgical product, does that suggest the kind of splitting the difference between those two? How much will Johnson & Johnson's business in the future be on what some are called high-tech medical devices versus maybe kind of mid-tech medical devices, devices that have maybe a little bit longer shelf life, but aren't so volatile, aren't in such volatile sectors or segments of the industry?
I wouldn't try to read too much into the strategic positioning of the different businesses. You know, a couple thoughts. One is, I love having good core businesses where we've been in for a number of years, aka Suture Minimally Invasive Surgery, where you build a lot of capabilities, long, strong relationships, where you can still have, I believe, iterative innovation that makes a difference and allows you to do very well. At the same time, you want to create new growth opportunities. Again, that could be ENT, you know, that we talked about earlier. Biosurgicals is a big area for us. And by the way, our biosurgicals business within, you know, was fostered within Ethicon. And right. So people would have thought, wait a minute, now you're getting into thrombin, fibrinogen, and you know all these other capabilities. Trust me, I was just in Israel last June, went over, and if you looked at our new biosurgicals facility over there, it's as high-tech as any biologics company in the world. And the capabilities, frankly, we couldn't do that were it not for some of the people from Centocor on the supply chain side, but also in the clinical development, in the regulatory side. And so, you know, putting those kind of opportunities together, we think they can be done ultimately if it's in service of helping the patient. So I wouldn't read too much into that. At the end of the day, you've got to organize yourself. Yeah. You know, have certain governance. But again, what we're trying to look for is what are the common customer call points, where are some of the capabilities that we can share. But what you also see, and we really try to emphasize, is that regardless of where a company sits in an organizational chart, more importantly, is how can you connect them to the right skills?
Right.
And you know, again, I mentioned some of the things that we did, you know, we're doing right now with our fibrin pad. We could not get that product out were it not for our pharmaceutical groups. And I think it's going to be a huge challenge for a pure med tech play to be able to bring those capabilities to bear to make that kind of a transformational product. So I think convergence offers a tremendous opportunity for J&J, because look, a lot of the, what I'd call the single approach solutions, whether it was, you know, a simple pharma product, a simple device product, they've been figured out. And I, to get to a lot of these next generation, these, think about oncology, many other areas, we're gonna have to get, I think, much more targeted, take much more complex approaches to the way we go about solving those problems. And so that's where I think convergence really positions J&J
well. Well, I was gonna save convergence for later, but let me ask it now. So when I think about 2011, I think about two things which argue against convergence. One, Johnson & Johnson departs drug-eluting stents, where it was a pioneer, and Abbott splits its corporation into a medical device business and a kind of R&D-focused pharma business. And in fact, kind of the legacy guys stay with the medical device business. And I know more people privately who have worked on drug-eluting stents who said to me, that this is something we could never really justify if we'd known how much it was going to cost going forward. Doesn't that suggest that those kinds of connections are harder to make than have proven real value going forward?
No, I wouldn't. I think I can't comment so much on Abbott's. I think that there were other issues that may have driven the way that divestiture unfolded. Yeah. But if we look at it, and even our drug-eluting stent decision wasn't necessarily related to the technology challenge. It was really for the market challenge and then the resources that it would take to get it to where we needed to go. But if I think about some of the things right now, for example, that we have going on in our diabetes care area, we've got a very exciting compound in development in our pharmaceutical group. We've got a lot of exciting things going on in our life scan, our diabetes care, ranging from test strips as well as pumps and other new technologies that we're working on that I think will offer a real opportunity going forward. You know, I mentioned about some of the things we're doing in biologics. We have a lot of other programs going on that I won't get into all the details, where I see convergence as really being an enabling capability for us to bring very differentiated products to the marketplace.
So I want to, before we get into the some broader questions, I did want to come back to Ethicon. You started, when you came back and came back to Device, you came back as the group chairman of Ethicon, and it seems to me it's always had a kind of special place. In the new reorganization, I take your point about you've got to organize it somehow, but it does seem as if, you know, surgical products takes a thing. What do you see the role for Ethicon going forward? Will it have the kind of same historic primacy that it's had within the space? I mean, it just seems like a great franchise.
Oh, I could not agree with you more. I think it's a tremendous franchise. I think one of the biggest challenges we had is we had split the two organizations apart, Ethicon Endosurgery and Ethicon, and there's always a lot of pride in just the way you organized and accountability. And so bringing those two together, again, it was the customer point for us there that's really driving that. And I'm excited. I mean, it's kind of like your children. You love all of them. Maybe you love some a little bit more at one time or another. But if I look at the Ethicon franchise right now, you've got this huge centerpiece in our wound closure business that's doing very well right now. We're doing a lot of things in emerging markets as well as continuing to, you know, improve the core business. You've got the energy business that's taking off and doing extremely well, and that was out of Ethicon Endosurgery in the minimally invasive surgery space. We've got these other opportunities with Omrix and the biosurgicals. You know, we're very hopeful we're working with the FDA right now on the Fibrin pad. You got Acclarent that's doing very well. So there's a lot of nice growth opportunities. In fact, last year, Ethicon was one of our fastest growing franchises, and who would have thought that only a few years ago?
Exactly. As the old saying goes, got three great kids and two others.
That's right.
So a lot of the spaces that were really high flying.
I was always the other one.
Exactly. So a lot of the spaces that were really high flying in the 1990s and early 2000s, interventional cardiology, spine, have seen growth slow dramatically. We were talking before about how important devices have been to Johnson & Johnson. As you think about devices as a broad category, can devices continue to provide the kind of growth and profitability that Johnson & Johnson needs from them? Or will pharma, it seems, has always been kind of the engine for both for profitability and for valuation at large companies like Johnson & Johnson. Mm-hmm. Can devices continue to deliver for Johnson & Johnson?
I mean, I think one of the beauties of Johnson & Johnson is our very diversified model. And, you know, just like a family, when one of those children kind of falls back a little bit, another one takes off a little bit, that's exactly what we find at J&J. And you think back a couple of years ago, when MD&D, when the medical device space was growing in the higher single digits. And at that time, we encountered some major challenges in our pharma business with generic expirations. Over about a 2 or 3 year period, I think we had more than $7 billion go off patent. And there's not many other companies out there that could take that kind of a hit, you know, over a couple year period and basically, you know, keep Johnson & Johnson moving along. But, you know, at that time, we saw MD&D growing very rapidly in a number of different ways. Over the last couple of years, we have seen the medical device market slow down. And I think, you know, one of the big questions that we'll, you know, have to see how it unfolds over the next few years is this a secular or is this a cyclical shift? And what I can tell you is that whether it's orthopedics that was growing at about 8% and is now down to about 2 or 3%. I mentioned stents earlier. Even in general surgery, in our core Ethicon business, that suture market is like a linear plot. 2.5% year in, year out. And for the first time over the last couple years, we saw it actually go into a negative growth rate. And just the sheer percentage of surgeries that, you know, utilize suture tells you that it's a pretty good indication of what's going on. But we saw that literally in all of our businesses. And but when you have a major, one of the world's greatest recessions, when you've got unemployment around the world, reported unemployment at 9%, real unemployment likely closer to 20%, 15 to 20%, when you see the expiration of things like COBRA benefits, it's not a surprise. And by the way, when you also saw copays in markets like the United States and austerity measures put into place in places in the developed markets in Europe, you can understand why that's going to temper demand. But when I think about demographics, when I think about emerging market growth, when I think about some of the great technology, I can't predict how we're going to recover from this recession. And I'll leave that to the presidential candidates as they're going through that process right now. But there's one prediction I think I can make with a fair amount of certainty for all the reasons I just mentioned. Demand for healthcare will increase for the next several generations. In fact, I would say one of the biggest challenges facing the generations represented in this room is how are we going to deal with that increased demand for healthcare? Mm-hmm. And so I still believe healthcare is a great place to be. I still think it's, you know, just calling for transformational innovation. It's going to be different kinds of innovation. It won't be the old model, but there's not many places in business where you can do so good, so much good, and do so well at the same time. And so I think we should all be really proud of what we're doing.
So you raised the issue of innovation. I wanted to talk more about that in any event. And you framed it in the context of healthcare reform. I wonder if you can frame how you think the product offering or the value proposition that companies like Johnson & Johnson will have to frame for customers is going to change going forward. We've heard about cost benefit and impacts on the healthcare system for years. Johnson & Johnson was one of the companies most responsible for the growth of minimally invasive surgery. But this discussion feels different. It feels as if we're talking about a different kind of innovation that pushes against some of the kind of very high-tech, very outcome-oriented, very kind of patient-focused healthcare. People throw around phrases like reverse innovation and even negative innovation. What will innovation mean both to Johnson & Johnson and to medical devices going forward, and maybe even to pharma?
No, I think it will be different. And just yesterday, I was in Southern California and had a chance to have a long conversation and participate in a dialogue with Dr. Berwick, the former head of CMS, and we had a lot of dialogue around what kind of innovation we're going to be needing. And I think listening to a lot of my colleagues, trying to look at the marketplace, hearing what's going on around the world, there's a few key themes. I think one is the days of just incremental innovation, changing the angle 10 degrees, taking 10% in price, that's going to be a very difficult market. That's going to be a commoditized market. I think when you can go in and demonstrate a difference in technology where you improve efficacy, you improve safety, and you can add value in some way, I think there still remains a significant opportunity there, or where you can totally transform a procedure. I think the thing we have to be cognizant, though, is so often policymakers and pundits will say, well, we should only be out there and paying for this transformational. Well, as any of the scientists in here know, how often do you really see big bang transformational technology right away? You don't. In fact, that's the riskiest form, I believe, of innovation versus you start here, you go 10 degrees, you go 10 degrees. Before you know it, you go from A to G, and you really see significant change. And so we have to maintain a system, I think, that rewards some of that innovation, that allows for it, takes place over time. I do think there's going to be a greater demand on value. I believe that we're going to have to produce more clinical information. And that's to get the products approved. I think we're going to need to produce more clinical information to demonstrate the value and actually get reimbursement.
So let me wrap up two concepts in one question, because I would suggest to you that the way people are thinking about this is kind of, I wouldn't say an assault, but almost a questioning about the value of incremental technology. And some people say, if you want to see where this is coming, look at emerging markets. Now, Johnson & Johnson just set up an R&D center in China. And some people look, when GE talks about reverse innovation, they talk about a 50% solution for 15% price. We're going to develop different kinds of technologies that are much less, don't have quite all the bells and whistles or quite all the features and benefits, but we can produce them a lot less efficiently. Talk a little about what you're doing in emerging markets and whether you see the model for innovation in emerging markets having any applicability in the West or the kind of established markets.
Absolutely. I think as I go around the world, it's one of the greatest parts of my job is being able to travel around literally to every country in the world and meet with people who are incredibly bright, working on the latest technology. And around the world, you see healthcare crying for two things. One, produce products that are more effective and safer. And two, how can we get that effect for less? And by the way, I think that second form of innovation is as important frequently as the first is, particularly when you're thinking about emerging markets. And when we talk to people in China, they want to hear a lot about our healthcare system. They don't necessarily want to import our healthcare system over there, but they want to learn from us. But we're absolutely opening technology centers there. And I think the medical need in many of those emerging markets is going to be different. And the example that I would give, we heard from a couple of companies today talking about the obesity space in the U.S. and the huge opportunities here. If you go to emerging markets right now, there's probably more of an issue around thoracic surgery or pulmonary issues because of the medical need that they're meeting locally. And really being able to identify those unique medical needs in those environments, in those regions, develop local solutions, and that's why we're putting R&D sites into many of those centers. And ideally, I love the idea of then saying, okay, how would you take that and bring it back to the developed markets? Right now, emerging markets for us represent probably 12 to 15% of our total sales. So developed markets are going to be important for a long time. You can't walk away from the United States. You can't walk away from Western Europe. But the emerging markets are growing at about 4 to 5 times the rate that you're seeing the developed markets growing. So I think you need to do both. You need to come up with ways to take some procedures, simplify them in the U.S., make sure you're adding a lot of value and develop. You need to go to emerging and say, do we have the right approach? And not simply taking the U.S. knee that you used 10 years ago, taking it over there, dropping the price by 30, 40, 50%, and trying to put it into the marketplace. That's what we're trying to do differently.
So when I think about the great stories in the recent years in medical devices, I think about companies like CoreValve, Acclarent, Ardian, very, very high tech companies that pioneered really brand new procedures that people, you know, wouldn't have dreamed of years ago and fetched a high valuation. When you think about where innovation is going and about the kinds of things that customers will demand, will there be Ardians and Clarence 5 years from now?
Absolutely.
Will those companies still get rewarded for the kind of effort they're doing?
Absolutely. You know, we saw, for example, when we looked at Acclarent, we didn't go after Acclarent just for Acclarent's sake. Great company, Josh. Don't give you a hug. And Bridget, who runs Acclarent now, wonderful technology. But when we looked at it, we were looking at the ENT space, the ears, nose, and throat space. And when we compared that to a lot of the other places out there, it was an area of great unmet medical need. One of the number one reasons, as everybody knows, that you go in to see a primary care physician is sinusitis. And when we looked at that, then we were thinking, how might we apply some of our other technologies in that area? What kind of capabilities would it bring? We saw a great opportunity there. And so we saw Clarent as a great way to help provide a platform to enable us to grow. So absolutely, those things are still going to be important. But the future development at Acclarent for emerging markets might look different than some of the things we're going to do for the developed markets.
So I promise, Susan, that I won't ask if you overpaid for any company in the last couple of years. But the question is,
tell Susan she overpays for every company.
The question is, will those kinds of companies fetch the same kind of valuation? We saw $1 billion-plus potential for Artie and Andrews in the audience there. CoreValve and Acclarent were in the same range. Those are great valuations, and people in this audience love those kinds of stories. But the question is, can the guys like Johnson & Johnson, Medtronic, who are paying those now, will they still have put the same kind of value on those technologies going forward?
Well, I'll give you the economist answer. It depends. I mean that sincerely. I think, again, what it's going to mean is, what kind of data are you going to have to produce? What are you going to have to think about as you're designing that entire concept? That's all going to go into the valuation.
So one of the things that you now oversee before you become CEO is JJDC. And I would argue, Johnson Development Corporation, Brad's here in the audience. I would argue that a decade ago, Johnson Development Corporation almost rescued the device industry by being willing to invest in device companies when VCs were fleeing the space. Do you see any changes in direction or philosophy or strategy for an organization like Johnson & Johnson Development Corporation because of all the stuff that's going on in the marketplace?
You know, first I'd like to recognize Brad Vill in the audience, who's just done us. He's done a tremendous job for JJDC. Is, you know, I think well recognized throughout this community for not only the connection that he provides to Johnson & Johnson, but frankly for the experience and capability that he brings when he's a board member into the community. And so we're very fortunate to have Brad. And the other part that I thank Brad for is, unfortunately, he cycles through a new boss about every 3 or 4 years, and he has to retrain them because they all tend to come in maybe with a different vision. So what I would say is JJDC is a bit like biology. It's an evolving organism. And what we've seen is, during different phases, as the whole venture world has gone through different phases, JJDC's got to evolve. And we've seen that ourselves. You know, one of the things that we did over the last few years is create the idea of Red Script Ventures, where we saw that people really wanted access to some of our internal capabilities from a clinical development and regulatory, point of view. We have to think about it in terms of our portfolio. What we do in the venture world in medical devices is very different than what you do on the pharma side.
Right.
And so we will always be evolving that market based upon our approach based upon what's going on in the marketplace and what we think is the right, getting the right need at that time. But it's an absolutely critical part of our R&D efforts and of our business development, and we see it as critically important to our business.
I want to ask you just briefly about white space opportunities. J&J is so diversified. It's hard to imagine. Are there white space opportunities? Any places that you're not currently in? And let me throw one at you, which is the whole area of digital, mobile, wireless health. What are Johnson & Johnson's plans for that space? Do you have a growing position there, or is that something you're looking at?
A few comments. I think because of the breadth and depth of our portfolio, it's almost hard to say true white space at times. But I think there's a few that come to my mind. One is the whole wireless space. And whether you want to call it microelectronics, wireless, it's hard to put your thumb on exactly. But what I do believe that's going to have a significant impact on healthcare going forward. And whether that's in helping us better diagnose, better sense, better monitor, better deploy systems, we are convinced that in one way or another, that's going to be an important capability in the future and something that we're going to have to be involved with. Otherwise, you run the risk of, you know, somebody leapfrogging over you. This whole area of regenerative medicine. And again, it's one of those that has always had a lot of promise for a lot of years. Yeah. I got to tell you, it's tough slogging scientifically. When you think about some of our approaches, and what I'm extremely proud of our DePuy company, when you go in for a hip or knee replacement, what do? We basically amputate. And why can't we come up with approaches in the future that help regenerate some of those things, better detect it earlier on, regenerate some of those areas? So I'm very hopeful that the diabetes space, with some of the things that we can do with beta cells going in the future, but it is tough science. Mm-hmm. And we're gonna fail a lot of times, and you know, eventually we're gonna get some breakthroughs, and we shouldn't expect them tomorrow, but if companies like Johnson & Johnson and others that you mentioned, if we're not investing there, you know, I'm not sure who will. So I think that's an important area. And the other one for me is we spend so much of our effort and energy and focus on treating patients versus how do we prevent things from happening? How do we keep patients well? And so I remain excited about the idea of, you know, some of our diagnostics areas where we can better identify which patients may to respond to a particular therapy, and that's very difficult. Right. There's been a lot of promise and what I call cocktail conversation around that for the last few years, but I think there's some real promise there on saying not only which patients may respond, but maybe which patients you don't want to put right on a particular therapy, or you know, when should we be more aggressive in replacing that knee versus not? And that's a third area where I think there's a lot of potential.
Going back to the wireless and sensor, just for, will Johnson & Johnson have an independent effort, or will it leave it to, you know, the cardiovascular business to look for those kinds of technology applications, the orthopedic, for those that, you know, there are companies like, you know, they're doing sensor applications in various clinical spaces. Do you need to kind of boost it with a focused effort, or is the mandate to the individual businesses, this can be an important technology for your space, figure it out?
And one of the things that I found in my career at Johnson & Johnson, one of the worst things you can do to a technology early on is say, this is coming from corporate.
Yeah.
you know, versus having it come up. But we do recognize that in certain areas, if you don't add that extra momentum by making it a corporate priority, it just doesn't happen. So we're actually doing, you know, both of those things. There are multiple initiatives coming up from within our businesses, but we're also looking at how can we harness some of those core capabilities to make sure that we're, sharing best practices and knowledge across the organization.
So the other issue that Johnson & Johnson Development Corp raises is the whole issue of deal-making. You grew up in the pharma world where deal-making is integral. It's also on a much different scale. It's much larger. There's a lot more of alliances. Pharma, it's different. It's more limited. It's more M&A-oriented. When you think about two of the high-profile deals you've done, and you've done others, but Synthes versus Acclarent, will Johnson & Johnson, is it possible for Johnson & Johnson to move the needle with an Acclarent kind of deal, or will you be looking for Synthes critical mass deals? And are there enough of those out there to move a company the size of Johnson & Johnson?
David, I believe that both are necessary, but neither are sufficient. And I think you need to play both. Mm-hmm. And if we only go for the big bets, you're going to end up overpaying, and I think it creates a certain risk quotient. On the other hand, when you're a $65 billion company, if you only go out and do, you know, a $50 million, $100 million, $500 million deal, you're right, it does get difficult to move the needle. So I think What's key for us, as I mentioned earlier, is how do you have the discipline within your portfolio to make calls where you see the growth opportunity, where you want to go big, where are others that you look at as an adjacency that you want to add on in a more moderate pace, and what are others, frankly, that you don't think you want to be in and don't offer the real growth potential.
So we're getting close to the end. Let me just ask you a couple of other questions. One of the other areas you're overseeing right now is supply chain, where you have responsibility for J&J's manufacturing plants. Product recalls have been an important issue for Johnson & Johnson in orthopedics and consumer products. Why has that been such a difficult thing to get your hands around, and how close do you think Johnson & Johnson is to overcoming those recall issues?
You know, well, let me first say that all of us at Johnson & Johnson are very disappointed in some of the events over the last year. And, you know, our first obligation is to make sure that we got a quality product out there for the moms and dads that depend on those products for their children. And look, clearly there are things that we recognize we needed to get in and fix. And what we have done over the past year is created a global supply chain, which includes both our manufacturing capabilities as well as our quality, and have them report into a single issue versus each of them was distributed within the businesses. They're now reporting into a global supply chain that actually I have responsibility for. And where we saw that being important is to make sure, you know, one, is that we're sharing all the best practices across those, that we standardize some of the quality processes. And because of the way that we've grown in the past, some of that's been more pragmatic than strategic, where now we see clearly we're in need, it's the right thing to do from a quality perspective. But also from a manufacturing perspective, I mentioned earlier some of the capabilities that we're sharing. We certainly think we can be more efficient in certain ways. And so we've learned a lot of lessons. I think we've made a lot of progress, and while we've had those events that I mentioned earlier and that we take full responsibility for, I still want to highlight the fact that, and by far the majority of the cases, we continue to provide, you know, great products for people around the world in a very consistent and dependable manner.
Johnson & Johnson's always had such a phenomenal brand. Do you worry that those product recalls will have a lingering effect even after you fix the problems, or are you confident that people have known and seen great products from Johnson & Johnson over the years and that with assurances that you fix the problem, your customers will come back? Any evidence that there's going to be long-term ramifications of those issues?
I've been amazed at the resiliency of the J&J image and reputation. If you look at our reputation scores, clearly there has been, you know, some negative movement, but relative to many other companies, it remains very strong. And I think our commitment is, you know, rather than going out and just, quote, working on the reputation, fix the problem first. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, mission number one is to make sure that we get the quality problems taken care of, which we're fully focused on right now. But I've got a lot of confidence when you look at the life-saving nature of our products. The other example that I use, let me see if it works in this room. When I say baby shampoo and baby powder, how many people in here can smell it right now? Okay, that's iconic branding. And I do think that there's a special place that those brands have, but we're going to have to go back and earn and win those places in the consumer's mind, because clearly those who have transitioned to other products are going to say, you know, why do I go back in now for J&J? Give me a reason to believe. But I'm very confident that, you know, our groups around the organization will rise to that challenge.
So you're about to become CEO. You're not yet. You have about 6 weeks to go, and I don't know how much you can say about it, but let me ask you just a couple of questions about that. First, when did it become clear to you that you must have thought about it, if not dreamed about it, for years. when did it become clear to you that this was in your sights, that this was a real possibility for you personally?
The Friday before it was announced. look, it's... It's been a long process, you know, all I can say is I'm incredibly honored and humbled, and I couldn't think of a greater opportunity and privilege than to serve this great company with our associates around the world. But it's one of the few times in my career, as I told people, where I actually was informed where I really didn't know what to say. It's still settling in a little bit. I've got six more weeks to reflect on that. But I think that hey, we've got some tremendous opportunities ahead. And yes, we'll have our challenges. There's no doubt about that. But it's a great organization.
You bring a broad perspective. Say you started in the pharma industry. We barely talked about pharma. The medical device business is just MDD, just went under a major reorganization. Do you think that you'll take the same kind of scalpel to the pharma businesses, or do you have any sense of what's in store for the pharma businesses?
Look, I think I have nothing but great things to say about Sherry McCoy, Paul Stoffels, Joaquin Duato, our leaders on the pharmaceutical side. If you think about our pharma group, you know, for somebody that was there through, you know, the great 90s and early part of the 2000s when you were seeing that business grow at a double-digit rate, to take the generic expirations that we saw and go through really significant change and then to rebound the way that they have over the past few years is incredibly exciting. Most analysts now, if you ask them, they would say we probably have got the best pipeline, the best products out there. We've had more than five new products approved over the last 18 months. We've had the strongest growth of any major pharmaceutical company over that same period. And these are products, you know, like Zytiga for prostate cancer that we just got some great new data. They're looking fantastic. Look at what we have in HIV. Look at what we have, some very promising things in Hep C, in cardiovascular, in our neuroscience area. Again, across a number of platforms, some really life-saving, life-changing compounds. I think that team has done a fantastic job. So the pharma group is going to be absolutely essential to our growth going forward.
So in medical device, as I said before, Johnson & Johnson is a powerhouse, the largest in the industry. In the pharma space, you look up at a number of large companies with very strong R&D heritages and kind of cultures. Does that at all change your thinking about how you look at the pharma space? Is there some catching up that Johnson & Johnson needs to do in the pharma space as it looks up, as opposed to in J&J? To be honest, you know, I don't say you look down on, that's a poor phrasing, but you know, everybody else is looking up at Johnson & Johnson in the device space.
You know, I would say, David, that I wouldn't necessarily agree with the point that bigger is better when it comes to pharma R&D. Mm-hmm. If anything, over the last few years, if you look at R&D, I think a lot of the great compounds have come out of smaller labs with very committed people, obsessed with getting a unique approach and molecule to the market. The same thing can probably be said for MD&D. And so if you take a look at what Sherry and Paul Stoffels have done, you know, Paul took Tebotec, a relatively small, you know, company that really focused on HIV. And when you look at what he created in terms of compounds, the number of lives that they've touched and the business that that's grown, I think that's more the model, frankly. And again, there too, we've taken an approach where we're focusing on five therapeutic areas. We're still looking at white spaces in between, developing a lot of knowledge, and I think that's what's led actually to the increase of productivity and getting compounds through that are really making a difference.
I think if you ask most big pharma CEOs at big pharma, they would say to you the business model is broken and we're struggling with how to fix it. I think if you ask most CEOs of big medical device companies, they wouldn't necessarily the model, they'd say there's lots of problems, but they wouldn't necessarily the model is broken. Do you think the business model in pharma is broken and in need of repair?
Business model in pharma?
Yeah.
I think that the business model in pharma has undergone a lot of change. And I think if you look at it in almost any sense, whether it's R&D organizations, commercial organizations, the way they've approached it, it's still going through a fair amount, but I think it's changed radically. Certainly ours has, and I think going through that change, you know, we actually went through that, you know, massive valley before a lot of the other pharmaceutical companies. So we endured that pain, but it required a lot of change in the way that we did things. Again, from an R&D side, from a commercial side. I think if we look at MD&D, and that's why having spent time in pharma and now being in MD&D, what I would say is that MD&D has been a little bit more protected over the last several years. But I do see changes occurring. I think that we're seeing that now. Part of that having to do with the shift in power and decision making from surgeons to more of the economic buyer, a hospital system, getting that balance right going forward, the way that we do in R&D. So I think there'll be change occurring there. Look, we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater,
right,
but I think we also have to realize that what worked 10 years ago is not going to work over the next 10 years.
Yeah, when you say protected, you mean the broader dynamics of the device industry versus the broader dynamics of the pharma industry.
Yes.
So one quick question about consumer products. Have you been in consumer products before? And I know J&J has been streamlining, you know, selling off some of its OTC brands. Do you envision continued selling off some brands, or will you be adding additional brands? What's in store for consumer products?
No, it's not an area of our business where I've worked before, but obviously having been on our executive committee for the past several years, I've had optic, you know, into that portion. Again, there, I think Sherry and Jesse Wu have done a very, very good job through some incredibly difficult times. The consumer business remains core to who we are at J&J for the reasons I mentioned below. People brand Johnson & Johnson based upon our consumer brands. We think it adds a nice balance to the overall portfolio and frankly gives us some really unique insights as consumers are going to get more and more involved not only in their overall healthcare bill, but whether it's pharma, even some of the devices. You know, we were talking today about, you know, what kind of healthcare system will we have? Will there be different? And so I think having that consumer involved, having those insights is a really important piece of who we are.
So I think I speak for everybody in the room when I say that people really look forward with great confidence to Alex Gorsky as CEO of Johnson & Johnson. I think they couldn't have made a better choice. What kind of time frame do you think it's going to take for you to put your imprint on Johnson & Johnson in terms of being able to clearly identify Alex Gorsky's stamp on Johnson & Johnson and the strategies the company's pursuing?
You know, I'm always reluctant to say it because I don't think it's about my imprint. I really think it's about who we are at Johnson & Johnson, our credo, the business model that we've had, and the 125,000 great employees that we have around the world. We recognize we're gonna have to change to meet the evolving needs of the customer. I've been part of our strategic plan for the last several years, so shame on me if I suddenly come in and have to change direction completely. Then what have I been doing?
Yeah, but now
for the past several years.
But now you're the boss.
But now, well, I don't know about that. I think the most important thing that I can do is support them and make sure they're getting the resources and everything else that they need. But again, it's a true honor and a privilege and. I'm obviously very excited about the future.
So Johnson & Johnson credo is one of the most interesting documents, if you call it that, in all of industry. I think it's been such a lifeblood of the industry for, you know, well over 100 years now. How different do you think Johnson & Johnson will be in 5 or 10 years, different from what it is today?
You know, it's hard to predict the future. One thing that I would say won't change will be our commitment to the credo. And I think most of you are aware of it, but it's this document that was, you know, written in the over 40 years ago by General Johnson himself that really talks about our commitment, first of all, to customers, to patients, mothers, fathers that use our products, next to our employees, to make sure that they're in an environment that's safe, that's, you know, where they can develop. About our communities, and this was long before it was cool to be green, and you know, to have a day where you did Habitat for Humanity around the block, and then finally to the shareholder. And if you did number 1, 2, and 3, 4 should pretty much come where it is. And what I'm really proud of, and I say this, you know, very sincerely, is I think most companies have a credo of sorts, a value system that will be on a wall. And I have seen this one in action in Johnson & Johnson, where you're having a discussion about a product or a recall and somebody says, this is a credo issue, and it changes the whole tone of the discussion. And we don't get it right all the time, and I don't ever want to insinuate that. We have to continue to try to do better. But I do think it causes a different kind of conversation to take place. And again, it makes me really proud of the organization. And I think that won't change. I think what we will have to change is as healthcare evolves, as the demands evolve, as, you know, patient needs evolve, we're going to need to evolve with it in a lot of the ways that we've talked about today. And I think we're going to be well positioned to do that.
Well, I say sincerely that I don't think J&J could have chosen a better person to confront those. So I've run way over, which I apologize, but how often do you get to sit with Alex Gorsky and talk to him for this?
That's good. Time. Thank you, everybody.
Let's thank him. And Paul, can we take 10 minutes of questions? 2 minutes of questions. So if we could take 2 questions, we'll take them quickly, and we'll do it. Move to the microphone if you have one. Go ahead. You're up.
Thanks, Alex, for coming here. It was a great discussion. My name is Paritosh Ambekar. I'm from the business school. And the question is about...
So you actually got in.
sorry about that.
Okay.
So about the emerging markets and the strategy of J&J going forward, what do you think about the decentralized model and the, how can you use the synergies in, say, a product being developed in China and being transported into India or other parts of the world? How does that work, and how does the decentralized model of Johnson & Johnson help or hinder that?
That's a good point. We didn't really talk about decentralization as such a core cornerstone of what Johnson & Johnson does. But how, when you look at large emerging markets, do you capitalize on the opportunities with a very decentralized structure? Who's to say that Ethicon won't leap ahead and Janssen fall far behind?
It's a great question. It's one that I wish I could say we get absolutely right. But I think we found a couple things. One is that an emerging market is not an emerging market is not an emerging market. So China and India, while there are some overlaps, there's a tremendous amount of differences between those markets. And if you compound that with what's going on in Brazil or a place like Russia or even the Middle East, very different places. However, we're trying a few different things. In some of those markets, we're actually taking a more unified Johnson & Johnson approach so that there's a connectivity back to the different franchises into the different sectors, but we also have clear strategies within a particular country where we think critical mass with customers is very important. That's number one. Two, a lot of it's built up around the innovation too, putting innovation centers where we can have teams working across the different areas, and that's consumer, pharma, and MD&D we found to be very important. But again, the China MD&D model and their pharma model and consumer can be very different than what you see in India. So there's some opportunities there, but we still think ultimately we want to be close to the customers. And anything that touches the customer, for the most part, we think should be decentralized. If it's not touching the customers, then we'll look at what do we need to do to standardize it, where it's not going to make a difference, so we can be most effective, most efficient.
Okay, that's good. One more question.
My question also relates to the emerging market. My name is Kouros Azar. I'm a surgeon and also an engineer. Along the line of the emerging markets, one way to think about it is that today, if you look at the 2+ billion people living, maybe 3 billion living in that market, some of them may not have access to a Band-Aid, and 5 years from now, they might be asking, is this a 64-slice CT scanner or 128-slice scanner? So there'll obviously be some more sophistication there. Is J&J looking at providing that technology directly more towards the frugal innovation side of things or more towards just providing the technology that's not currently available?
And you just you opened an R&D center, as I said, in China.
No, we definitely think getting to the S2 is going to be essential, you know, getting to that other market. You know, one is basically a credo call just to only go to that top tier of patients. We don't think we'd be fulfilling our commitment, but two, we think there's a tremendous business opportunity, but it's a different kind of business opportunity than what you see in a lot of the other areas and by what we've historically done. We've made some great inroads into that in the consumer area. We're looking at that in pharma. Frankly, it's a little bit more challenging. And in MD&D, based upon some of the R&D centers and the things that we've done, we're very committed to that.
Great. Well, again, I wish we could take this on for longer. We've got to go. There's a reception outside. But let's thank Alex once again for
Thank you very much, everybody.
You've got to have an unbelievable schedule. We really do appreciate it.
David, thank you so
Alex,
much.
Thank you so much.
Really appreciate it.
Yeah.